Proceed to the third case, Bean versus Wisconsin Bell. Ms. Hines.
Good morning. May it please the court. We're here today to decide a couple of main issues. I think perhaps the defense has attempted to make this a more difficult case than it need be. The first issue we believe for resolution is the district court's grant of the counterclaim for the defense on the relocation payment to the plaintiff. This was improper. It was an issue of fact for the jury, as we've explained in a number of cases, including one written a few years ago by yourself, Judge, the Schultz v. Baumgart case, which specifically decided the issue of whether the plaintiff resigned or was terminated is a question of fact for the jury. Now, the defense has attempted to bring the Wisconsin case law standard into this, but the cases cited by the defense deal with the question of unemployment compensation and are very different cases and a very different standard of law, and we would argue that they do not apply. This also applies to the supplemental authority brought by the defense, which was available to them at the time they filed their brief, but for whatever reason brought in late. As to the discrimination claims, there are two separate claims, although the evidence is similar for both. The first regarding...
So let me go back for a second to the question whether her act of standing up and walking out of the room after being told three times that if she did that, that would be tantamount to a resignation, is the kind of conduct from which one can infer that it is a resignation. I don't see anything in either federal law or Wisconsin law that says that somebody can't make that choice, particularly when at this point she's saying, well, I wanted to talk to my union representative who was sitting right next to her in the room. There's no indication that either she or any of the three union representatives said we'd like a brief recess so that we can confer, or in any way attempted to secure for themselves the ability to discuss what was going on. She's told if you get up and leave, I'm going to consider that a resignation. She's told twice. She's told a third time she gets up and leaves. I mean, why isn't that indisputably clear?
Well, because, Your Honor, we're saying that an employer cannot inject into an employee the intent to resign. It must be the employee's intent to resign.
Well, right, and it's her conduct after being told that. You know, as far as we know, she doesn't have a hearing impairment. She heard it. She understood what was being said to her. And employers do sometimes say, if you take a certain action, I'm going to consider that the tendering of your resignation. What's wrong with that?
Yes, employers say that all the time, but that does not make that a resignation, because what the case law says is the employee has to have the intent to relinquish employment, and there is evidence in the case here that was before the district judge that shows that Ms. Bean did not intend to resign. She asked to step out of the room only to discuss with her union representative.
Who was sitting right next to her in the room.
That's correct.
I mean, that's the crazy thing about this.
That's correct, except that she does have the right to confer with her union representative outside the hearing of the company's personnel, and that's what she was attempting to do.
She never asked to do that. She never, I mean, there's no indication that the union representative stood up and walked out with her, for example, even. So having her stand there in the hall isn't the best way to communicate with him.
Well, there actually is evidence in the record that she did step out and speak to her union representative, and while she was doing that was when the employer's personnel left the room and told her she was considered that
was her resignation. Right, because they had told her if she left the room. It wasn't like she needed to leave the room because she was fainting or she needed to go to the restroom or in any other respect had some reason that she really needed to leave the room right at that moment.
Well, except that she needed to discuss her options for returning to work under the same supervisor who had harassed her and given her directives on the basis of her race. She needed to discuss whether or not she wanted to return to work under those exact same circumstances with her union representative outside the hearing of the company representatives. And I don't think that's unreasonable.
What if she just went home and just didn't show up at work? And then when they say to her, look, you're not working, so, you know, it must be you've quit. She said, no, I haven't quit. I just don't feel like working.
No, I think that would be a clear case of her resignation. She would be taking an active
and
consistent with her employment.
She wouldn't have your subjective intent to resign. She just doesn't want to work.
Except that I think it could be shown that employees understand in general terms that if they repeatedly don't come to work.
All right, so we'll change things. She comes to work, but when she comes to work, she doesn't do anything. She just sits at her desk.
Again, that would be evidence that she had intent to resign.
No,
she said, I don't want to resign.
This is a great job. I'm being paid. I just don't like to work.
No, but she would be evidencing intent not to complete the job.
So what you're saying is you're acknowledging that a refusal to follow orders can be, under certain circumstances, can be treated by an employer as resignation.
It can be under certain circumstances,
but her intent
are not
may
those.
Be. I mean, that's the thing. In the example Judge Posner is giving you,
right.
Her subjective intent might not be to resign. Maybe she just wants to take a few days of lower stress work while she thinks about whether this is the right place to be. But
Your Honor,
those
kinds of facts in the record.
Facts in the record are she's told three times, if you get up and leave the room, we're going to consider that a decision on your part to resign.
And I think perhaps in a non-union environment, that may be considered sufficient evidence of a resignation. But when, as here, the employee is represented by her union and it does have the right under that contract to confer with her representative before being reinstated to the job, it is our position that once she asks to do that she has the right to do that, and by stepping out to confer with her union representative, she has not evinced any intent to resign. And in fact, she repeatedly stated to the defendant that she was not resigning. And she came to the employment when the employer asked her to do
but
so.
But I think what you're saying is the collective bargaining agreement could give her rights. That's true. But where does this collective bargaining agreement? Is there a collective bargaining agreement?
Yes, there is.
So where did it entitle her to this? To go outside and talk to him.
There is a provision in the agreement that does allow her to confer with her representative. At this point, I can't point you to a specific page, but it is part of the record. And furthermore, this is not an issue that was even discussed by the district court. The district court just said that it just took the evidence in the light most favorable to the defense and said, you know, by her stepping out after being told she would resign, that was resignation. He resolved that credibility issue, that issue of intent, in favor of the defense when it should have been one for the jury. And then at that
so
point,
you're not
the
talking
jury
about subjective intentions. You're saying she had an entitlement to confer outside with her collective bargaining representative.
That's correct, but she also had the subjective intent to remain employed.
That's weak.
Well, that may be, but we believe the evidence does show that she had that right and that she did not intend to resign, and if that is an issue that needs to be resolved, it should be resolved by the jury at trial. It's an issue of fact, not one of law, and our cases in this circuit clearly indicate that.
She had three representatives in the room, didn't she, not just one?
I believe so, yes. But there was a particular one that she asked to step out with, and she did so. That individual, incidentally, was also the same union representative who was allowed to confer with one of the other white employees that we have listed as a comparator in the suspension and the termination case. So that may also be additional evidence of pretext that those white employees.
Why didn't she want to talk to him in the presence of the employer? Was there something confidential?
Yes.
What?
She was concerned that she was being returned to work under the exact same supervisor, under the exact same racist, discriminatory conditions under which she had been suspended in the first
right,
place.
Right, but that's what she was telling her employer, right?
Yes, she was telling her employer
so why,
and her union.
Exactly, but why did she have to tell the
the same thing to the union fellow in private.
Because she was attempting to work out a circumstance under which she could return to work, but possibly resolve the racist condition.
Why wouldn't she want to work it out? Why wouldn't it be more efficient to have it worked out in the presence of the union and the employer? So she explains her situation. The union people say, well, you should do that. And then they figure something out with the employer, with everyone present. Why isn't that perfectly satisfactory?
Well, it would have been if they had allowed her to come back in after conferring with her union
representative. Why did she have to confer privately with the steward? Why didn't she just explain her situation? She's got her union people there and the employer people. And, you know, like an arbitration, she explains her position and they decide what to do about it.
Right, but this was not a question of taking testimony. This was a private conference with her representative.
It was a private conference, but with the union people were there. So since they were there, why not just speak her piece to them?
Because she should be entitled to confidentially confer with her representative.
What's the actual concrete value of that for her?
Because then she has the opportunity to help work with her union to propose a resolution to this issue so that she can come back to work and get it resolved for everyone.
You're treating the union as if the union person were her lawyer, in other words.
Well, and in this context, the union person functioned as her attorney.
Right, that's your argument.
Right. Right.
Did she have an opportunity to confer with the representative before the meeting?
That I don't know.
Was she informed before the meeting that she would have to return to work under the same supervisor?
Absolutely not. She found that out in the meeting, which was a huge shock to her, as the record indicates. She had thought that the company would have taken some response to her complaints of racist treatment by her supervisor, who, by the way, you'll notice in the record, her supervisor was only supervising her for 12 days before all of these issues came to a head. So we're looking at a lot of conduct that happened in 12 days, not even all of which she worked because some were weekends. And so this is the supervisor that we're also alleging treated her in a racist fashion vis-a-vis the white employees who were allowed to have union representation and who committed worse misconduct than anything Ms. Bean could have done. Both of the white comparators we cited, their conduct went beyond just disrespect and disobedience of a supervisor to include actual members of the public, customers of the company.
You know, I had a problem with your brief in this respect because you mention a few times this comment about an old hag, but you don't indicate ever that that individual never hears that. And I have to say, putting somebody on hold and then saying something unflattering isn't unknown in the workplace. If you come back on and you're courteous to the person then, it's not a good thing necessarily, but it's not something that's harmful to that member of the public.
Well, I'm not sure that even the record itself is clear as to whether or not that individual made the comment before or after being on the phone with that customer.
I saw nothing to contradict that allegation of fact.
Well, that may be, but
the record comes to us,
and that way
isn't as serious a point. And the other thing that's of concern to me is it seems quite clear that this coaching that goes on is, in fact, a part of the job, and there is, as I understand this CBA, no right for a union person to follow you around every minute of the day as you do your job.
But there was no request for that kind of conduct. There was only a request by Ms. Bean to have someone else present. It wouldn't even have had to have been a union representative.
But the coaching is part of the job.
It is, except...
So why do you have a right for the employer to take somebody off a different job that they're doing, double up because she needs somebody there with her? That's not a cost-free request for an employer.
That's true, but already, you know, a few days into the supervision, the employer, the representative, the supervisor, had already shown him to be racist toward her, had made numerous comments to her, was treating her in a disparate fashion versus the white employees, and had already demonstrated that he had no intent
of treating her the same as the white employees, and she was merely asking for someone else to be present. She was not refusing to be coached. She did not refuse to perform any of her job duties. She merely asked for someone else to be present to lessen the opportunity for this supervisor to behave toward her in a racist fashion. She was trying to do everything she could to continue to perform her job successfully as she had done for 10 years prior to this, and continue to work out the problems within the system. And it was the supervisor's conduct in plugging into the call and then shutting down her console and marching her into a conference room without telling her initially what the problem was when she was first suspended that led to all of this. And then the employer compounded the error by not informing Ms. Bean prior to this final meeting on April 8th, at which she was ultimately terminated, we contend, that she was going to be terminated, or if she did not return to work, and they didn't tell her that she would, if she came back, be subject to the exact same conditions that gave rise to these problems in the first place. Thank you.
Mr. Price?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brian Price. I'm counsel of record for the defendant, athlete Wisconsin Bell.
Is Wisconsin Bell a separate corporation still, or are they really
yes,
part of
it? Yes, it is a separate corporation.
Does the record show how big this Appleton facility was at the relevant time? I mean, it may not. I mean, you have
to be perfectly frank. To be perfectly frank, I don't recall whether the record shows exactly how big the facility was.
Okay, I just wondered.
What I'd like to address first this morning are several issues that Ms. Bean has waived, and then address some of the points that came up during the Ms. Bean's portion of the argument.
You didn't have an awful lot to say about this counterclaim in your brief. Got like a couple of sentences at the bottom of page 17. Is that all you have to say on this subject?
No, Your Honor. There is more to say, and part of the reason why the discussion on the counterclaim itself in the brief under that heading is a little short is because elsewhere in the brief the issue of whether she was actually discharged or resigned is addressed. At the outset, it's important to note that...
But they're separate issues. I mean, you could have violated the conditions of this, you know, relocation payment without having engaged in racial discrimination, and vice versa. You seem to treat them as the same issue.
Well, they're not the same issue, but they share one common, they overlap in one respect.
You wouldn't concede, would you, that if you terminated her, that it wasn't a resignation, that was racial discrimination? Would you? Maybe you do concede that.
No, we don't. And in fact, we argue in the brief that even if you assume she was terminated for walking out of the meeting, that there is no evidence that...
Right, but what she says is that whether she was terminated or not is a jury question, because this, you know, this complicates kind of obverse constructive termination. If you somehow precipitate your being fired because you lose an advantage if it's a voluntary resignation, well, that's treated as a voluntary resignation. But isn't it uncertain whether that's what was going on here?
Well, particularly in light of the fact that she articulated very clearly as she was walking out of the room, I am not resigning, in words to that effect. So she was doing what she could, in a sense, under protest, you know, if you will, we might say that, trying to refute the characterization that the employer was trying to put in her conduct. Why does that not destroy any inference from the conduct we could draw?
Well, because in the Klatt case, the supplemental authority we cited to you, the employee in that case was subject to a residency requirement. She was a police officer. She moved out of the jurisdiction. She was told, either move back in the jurisdiction or your employment will be terminated within 30 days. She says, I have no intent of...
That's not the same case. Suppose she thinks that mistakenly, that the company has no right, no legal right, to order her to remain in the room, that she has a right to go outside and talk to the employer. Now, she may be wrong, and she might be properly terminated for her mistake, for having done something that she thought she was entitled to, but she wasn't. But nevertheless, that would not be a voluntary resignation. And that's completely unlike the case you just gave.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree, because the admissible evidence of the record does not state that she was going to consult with her union rep.
Suppose you tell one of your paralegals or something to pick up a box and carry it into another room. The paralegal says, no, I'm a paralegal, and I have rights under the Constitution and natural law not to carry boxes. So you say, well, okay, you're fired. Well, again, he precipitated a discharge by an unreasonable position, but it still would be a discharge, rather than voluntarily, you know, putting yourself voluntarily resigning.
Well, that would be a discharge, but what makes this situation different is that this was the context of this meeting was that this meeting was to let her know what the expectations of her employment were, including when she could consult with a union representative.
The thing is, I mean, the context of the meeting is one thing, and she uses an ambiguous word, but actually I don't think the ambiguity matters much. She says, I wanted to go talk to counsel, whether that meant the union people or whether that meant, you know, pull out her cell phone, call a lawyer quickly, whatever. I mean, it seems to me either one she could have thought she had the right to do. She says, I'm not resigning, and they basically, they treat it as the end of her employment, to avoid using any conclusory words. And it seems very difficult to say that you can draw an inference from conduct when the person is specifically negating that inference. Whatever the purpose of the meeting was, to say you're going to keep working with Smith from now until you die, whether it's, you know, this, whatever. She knew that the meeting was about that.
Well, as I was saying before, in the Klatt case, the employee said, I have no intent of ending my employment relationship with you, to the employer. And the employer said, at the same time, you've got to move back in the jurisdiction within 30 days or you'll be terminated. On the actual termination day, she comes and still
says... But that's like saying that when you have one of these deals where you promise someone a golden parachute of some sort, if he's terminated, he gets something. It's implicit in all these contracts that the person has to not unreasonably precipitate the termination. That's implicit. So if you wanted to argue that, this is that kind of case, and somebody, I didn't see your argument about this. You seem to just assume that if it was, that if the company deemed it a resignation, that's the end of her counterclaim, regardless of the circumstances.
Well, no, Your Honor, that's not our position.
Where did you argue that? The only fact you said you were adding was the fact that she had been terminated, and that's, of course, the issue. I mean, that she'd resigned, and that's the issue.
Where we argued it, Your Honor, is on starting on page 48 and going on to page 49 of the brief. And the argument is that her conduct was...
No, I thought it was 52. I don't understand. 49 is, you're still talking, 51, you're still talking about race. It's not until 52 that you discuss the counterclaim issue, but it seemed to me, all I saw there...
On 52 we refer back to the arguments on pages 48 and 49.
But that's just about...
And there we argue that her conduct was inconsistent with the continuation of the employment relationship because she came...
Yes, but you see, that's a separate issue. That's the issue. The question is whether what happened was resignation within the meaning of this relocation payment provision. And I don't see where you ever addressed that.
Well, where we addressed it is on 48 and 49.
If you weren't talking about the counterclaim there.
Right. What we were talking about there was the discharge claim, and the overlap between the two of those is whether she was discharged or whether she voluntarily terminated her employment. And so we discussed it. We first discussed it in terms of the discharge claim, so we weren't going to repeat the same discussion. I refer back to it. But the point is that the context of this meeting was to give her the terms and conditions of employment. She comes
anyway,
to the meeting.
On pages 52 and 54, all you talk about is the waiver of the counterclaim issue. You don't talk about the merits of it. You never talk about the merits of it.
Well, we talk about it on pages 48 and 49.
No, you're not talking about the counterclaim. You're not focused on the meaning of this relocation payment provision.
Well, on page 54, I state, as discussed super in section 4B of the argument section of this brief, Ms. Bean voluntarily
abandoned
her employment.
You don't understand that these are different issues. That's your problem.
Well, the overlap between the two issues.
There may be overlap, but they're separate issues.
Well, the point is that in the purpose of this meeting was to give her the terms and conditions of employment. She comes in the meeting. She understands that to be the purpose of the meeting. She finds out that Mr. Smith is going to be her supervisor, that that's the term of the employment. And she admits, there's undisputed evidence in the record, that she walked out because Mr. Smith...
But she thinks she has the right to walk out.
Well, the evidence that supports that argument was stricken. This evidence that she was going to consult with a union representative was stricken from the record, and that issue has been waived. The only admissible evidence in the record is not that she's going to consult with counsel, but that she's going to consult with her attorney. No employee has the right, in the middle of a proceeding, to consult with an attorney. And that's the only admissible evidence in the record. The plaintiff appellant in this case...
She doesn't use the word attorney. She uses the word counsel, as I recall, in the record.
That was stricken.
Once again... if she thought she had the right to consult with anyone, if we're focusing on her intent voluntarily to abandon, and she thinks, erroneously in your view, that she has the right to talk to a lawyer before she gets put in an untenable situation like that, people do hire employment lawyers for these kinds of things after all, then why do we draw the inference of intent?
Because she came to this meeting to learn the terms and conditions of employment. During that meeting, she finds out that she's going to work for Mr. Smith. She doesn't like that term and condition of employment. She walks out of the meeting because of that after she's told three times, if you walk out of this meeting, it'll be considered your resignation. At that point, objectively, and it's objective intent, what is that issue? Objectively,
but
she knows...
To Judge Posner's point... it's certainly easy to see that that statement is a euphemism for saying, if you walk out of this meeting, you're fired. And if that's what it was, you, of course, have made the argument that based on her refusal to cooperate with the coaching and all of these other things in the record, the company was entitled to take that action. I take it that's your argument. But it does make a difference on the counterclaim with respect to whether she's got to repay this relocation allowance, because if it's just a euphemism for saying, if you walk out of this room, that's the final act of insubordination, we don't want to have anything to do with you anymore, you're fired, at that point she doesn't have to repay the money. Right?
But under the contract, if it's a voluntary ending of the employment, a voluntary termination, then she has to pay the money back.
What if it's termination for cause?
Then she does not have to pay the money back.
Even if it's termination for cause?
Yeah, all it matters is whether... phraseology is if you have to pay it back if your employment... if you involuntarily terminate your employment.
So if she murders the president of the company and is fired, she still gets her $15,000?
Well,
is that what you're saying?
It's a pretty... That's not the case that's in front of us.
No kidding. Really? Thank you. Thank you for enlightening me on that point.
I didn't...
So what's your answer?
Under the terms of the contract that she, as far as I understand it, she could...
Well, I don't think so. I don't think your client is going to be very happy with that answer.
Well,
I'm sure the client takes the position that terminations for cause do not trigger for obvious reasons. Then a person who wants to get her money is just do something outrageous that gets her fired.
Well, and I think that's exactly what we have here. We have somebody who leaves the room.
Oh, okay.
After they've
been
told.
Look what you've just said. I mean, you've dug a really deep hole for yourself. You've said that what she did was she behaved outrageously so that her employment would be terminated. But then you just said, well, even if she'd murdered the boss, she'd be entitled to her relocation payment. So she did something which wasn't quite as bad as that, and you're really conceding that she's entitled to the money.
Well, Your Honor, I think I answered the first question incorrectly. I mean, obviously, murdering the boss would be inconsistent.
Well, but you haven't argued the counterclaim thing.
Well, I think that... We're having a misunderstanding.
No, we're
here.
Not. You just failed to treat the counterclaim issue as a separate issue. You thought it stood or fell completely on whether she had proved her race case. That's not true. They're separate issues.
Well, I do think they're separate issues. What it stands or falls on is whether she was discharged or she was.
Now we know it does, right? Because if you're discharged because you behaved outrageously, you're not entitled to the payment.
But if you do it under circumstances that are inconsistent with the continuation of the employment relationship, that's when it takes
right.
It out of the
realm.
It has
nothing to do with voluntary resignation. It's just that this relocation, either implicitly or explicitly, does not permit people to precipitate the payment of the money or retention of the money by acting improperly.
Right, and that's why I said I think I answered your first question incorrectly.
Right.
I think even after argument, one is permitted to retract a misstatement in front of this court, and I would respectfully retract it.
Okay.
In light of
didn't you rely entirely, Mr. Price, that this is a voluntary termination and therefore you didn't feel there's anything to deal with? I mean, is your whole position rising and falling that it's a resignation and therefore if she resigned that's a voluntary act and the 14-5 is of no moment? Isn't that really where you're at on this?
Right, which is why after we discussed the element of the prima facie case of the discharge case, whether she was discharged or not, and we went on for two pages about why it shouldn't be considered a discharge, that's why under the counterclaim section, I merely referred back to the discussion
you feel your first point is so strong it carries the day, and we don't get to the second point, right?
That it's just a resignation,
right?
Right. That we dealt with that up under. We dealt with whether it is a resignation or a termination under the discharge claim. We also dealt with other elements of the prima facie case under the discharge claim, including some waiver issues. And so then, when you get to the counterclaim portion of the brief, I felt that what we should do is just refer back instead of repeating the same two pages of material back to you that we had given under the discharge claim under the element of she wasn't discharged, not under the element of she was satisfying the legitimate expectations, not under the element of similar situated white employees were treated more favorably. We went through a two-page discussion of there was no adverse action under the discharge claim. And therefore, I didn't repeat it all under the counterclaim.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Price.
Thank you.
Ms. Hines, your time expired, but you may have a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I indicated at first, I do think the evidence shows that we have presented the appropriate prima facie cases under both the suspension and the termination causes of action. And the real battle, I think, in this case is going to be fought on the issue of pretext, because I don't think this court should have much trouble deciding that she was suspended initially, which the defense does not contest, and that she was ultimately terminated, both of which are considered adverse employment actions under Title VII. And as I point out in my brief at the end of the issue on termination, because they rely on their waiver issues and the issues connected with the counterclaim, they don't even bother to give this court an alleged legitimate reason for what they consider her resignation. So especially on the issue of termination, there hasn't been enough presented by the defense here to have granted summary judgment in the trial court, and this court should reverse and remand for trial.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Hines.
Thank you.
Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under